You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Je suis candidat à la présidence de la République.
I am candidate to the presidency of the French Republic because I believe, most of all, that we can make it, that France can make it.
Un matin avec cette révélation.
As former French Economy Minister Emmanuel Macron indicates his intention to run for the presidency next year, my guests Daniela Pelled and Isabel Hilton will be discussing whether he is the man who can prevent the country from lurching to the far right. And we'll also be examining why the far right is on the rise, from post-Brexit Britain to Germany's attempts to tackle extremism. We'll also be checking in with the COP22 climate change summit in Marrakesh and asking how Donald Trump's future foreign policy will play out in China. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Daniela Pelled, managing editor for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Isabel and Daniela, welcome to you both. We begin in France, where the country's election race is heating up. They head to the polls next April. But today, former French Economy Minister Emmanuel Macron declared his intention to run as an independent. The former protégé of current socialist president François Hollande joins a race including veteran centre-right politician Alain Juppé, possibly former president Nicolas Sarkozy, and of course the Front National candidate Marine Le Pen. And after a year of political upsets, from Brexit to Donald Trump, it's fair to say no one wants to make a real prediction as to what might happen. Isabel Hilton, this is a strange election, as all elections seem to be at the moment in what we used to call liberal democracies, in that you have a socialist president, François Hollande, who, in a poll I saw the other day, had, I think, risen
to the
dizzy heights of 5% popularity. Mm. And yet, for some reason, there is still some debate as to whether or not he's going to run again, and odds are he probably will, which means that there seems to be this massive gulf anywhere from the centre-right to the left of potential candidates. How do you read Emmanuel Macron throwing his hat into the ring and the general state of the not Marine Le Pen vote?
Well, I guess Macron is trying to say, you know, if Hollande runs again, you know, it's a disaster. But you could vote for me instead. So I think that's quite tricky for him because he risks being tainted with Hollande's unpopularity. He's trying to distance himself from Hollande. And he's certainly trying to offer an alternative to the otherwise rather conservative field, which itself is currently divided but will coalesce around one candidate, probably still Juppé.
It's interesting, isn't it, Daniel, when you look at what's happening on the, let's call them the centre-right, the Republican Party in France. There's Alain Juppé, who, when he was in office in the mid-90s, was not in any way seen as a moderate figure. There's Nicolas Sarkozy, whose pronouncements on the burkini ban were as extreme, shall we say, as Marine Le Pen. It makes anyone who is not in that camp perhaps slightly nervous.
Well, I think so. I mean, Sarkozy would seem to be a very random choice for re-entry into this race. And certainly he's the one most likely to go for the populist approach, like all his pronouncements about halal meat and the burkini. But I think what Juppé has in his favour is that he is... from the current spectrum, he is the most safe pair of hands. He is the most conservative, and he's not the most exciting card in the pack, but I don't think that stands anything but in his favour. I mean, Le Pen is trying to position herself as the sort of counter-establishment candidate, but the Front National is getting pretty establishment in France. It's not. I don't think it can rely on this sort of mythical white working class anger.
Because that's the thing, actually, Isabel, is, I mean, look, we just did this at the start. I mentioned Brexit, I mentioned Trump. But actually, the Front National has a far deeper pedigree, really, in France. It's been, you know, obviously in 2002 when Le Pen Senior reached the second round. And even before then, there had been, it was a player, if not a major player that it is right now.
It does have a deeper pedigree. Not all of it is entirely unproblematic, I have to say. And a lot of what Marine Le Pen's been doing is distancing herself, both personally and politically, from her father, who was regarded as pretty nakedly racist and unacceptable. She is a much different offering. And she, you know, she looks good. She talks well. She's managed to detox the party's image quite effectively. And, you know, populism in France does have a substantial base. And if you look at the figures about sentiments towards the European Union, they're quite startlingly similar to the ambivalence that was felt in the British electorate before the Brexit vote. So I think that we shouldn't underestimate Marine Le Pen, and people have made that mistake before. Last year in the provincial elections, for instance, they did extremely well until the second round. And I think that this will all play out in the second round. And what France tends to do is, you know, you get a clear choice in the second round, and then everyone who is not National Front will gang up against her.
But do you think that's going to happen this time? Because look,
I think it will.
It happened,
yes,
in 2002, and 82% of voters voted for Chirac rather the thief than the fascist, as the placard said. But is that necessarily going to happen this time around? Because particularly if she's up against, let's say Sarkozy, you know, whose economic policies are free market, traditional right-wing policies. If you're on the left or in the centre, might you look at Marine Le Pen and think, well, look, if they're socially as extreme as each other, why don't I vote for Marine Le Pen, whose economic policies are more my cup of tea?
Well, I think it's certainly more likely if the right-wing candidate is Juppé, because, you know, a wider spectrum of people could stomach voting for Juppé than could stomach voting for Sarkozy, who is also a retread after all, and I don't think he's gained very much more credibility in this time that he's been out of office. We are in strange and interesting times. Perhaps it won't play out like that, but that certainly is how it has played out to date in French politics, and well, we shall see.
My worry, I mean, blimey, I have so many worries about what's happening here at the moment. But, Danielle, one of my big worries is that there is, when we talk about these elections, we're often talking about who we think moderates should be voting against rather than who they should be voting for, or rather sort of what the options are for voting for. Do you think that Macron or another figure in the centre or even on the centre right can actually say, look, this is what I'm for. Vote for me because of this platform, my ideals, not just because I'm best placed to stop Marine Le Pen?
I don't want to exacerbate your nightmares, but I don't think that's realistic right now. This is the situation that we are in, and not just in America, across Europe as well. I think for the next few years, we have to make pragmatic choices. People will have to vote holding their noses if necessary.
I'm not saying I've got a problem with people holding their noses when they vote, but it's the fact that so often the biggest argument for voting, let's say, for staying in the EU or for Hillary Clinton, often has seemed to be, I'm the best way of stopping this disaster from happening.
Well, I think because the disaster seems so disastrous. I mean, that's the most compelling argument. And perhaps in Brexit, if we had run a more negative campaign, I mean, I'm obviously on the side of Remain, but we could have been more negative, and that might have made a difference.
It was a pretty negative campaign, and it wasn't entirely clear, nor was it in the Scottish referendum, and that was a successful tactic. You know, the Scots had this expression, you know, too wee, too feared. You know, in other words, that those who wanted Scotland to stay were telling them that they're too little and too afraid to manage on their own. And it just got them more determined. And I think that, you know, this kind of, you know, what did they call it? The fear mongering, the
Project Fear
was an easy target. you know, for people who are selling, in my view, an illusion of you know, prosperity and freedom. But it's hard to challenge because it hasn't happened.
After the financial crash in 2008, Isabel, there was, you know, there were some people, particularly on the centre left, who thought, right, this is our moment. This is, you know, this shows what problems we've had with capitalism, certainly this form of capitalism over the last 20 or so years. And voters are going to see that this is the problem, and that the banks are the problem, and that the parties on the right who the banks support are a problem, and they're going to flock to us. That didn't happen. But also what's quite interesting now is that I'm looking at what Marine Le Pen today said about Emmanuel Macron, and she says Macron is the bank's candidate. And when you look at what Donald Trump was saying in the final 2 or 3 weeks of his campaign, he was talking about the banks and Wall Street and global capitalism. And there was obviously a slight anti-Semitic undertone, or indeed overtone, to some of those statements. But it was interesting that these so-called populists were actually cottoning onto the fact that for many people, there is still a lot of anger towards the banks. And they have managed to harness that in the way that the people you would have thought would have haven't.
Well, I think there's been a massive failure of a political elite to deal with the aftermath of that crisis. You know, in which, in this country, we've had endless rounds of austerity which hit the poor and the middle classes, whilst those who are perceived, and I think quite rightly, as having caused the disaster, have escaped pretty much scot-free. Now, The problem with the centre-left response to that is that the centre-left were seen as part of a political elite that had, you know, that had enabled this crisis and then failed to deal with it. So the Labour Party was as implicated as the Conservatives because they signed up to this neoliberal project, you know, many years ago, and they didn't come up with a robust alternative. It was very difficult to distance themselves from that commitment. We haven't had another offering. So what you have now is randomly directed anger, which finds expression through supporting insurgent parties. It's not the first time it happened, I have to say. It happened in Europe in the 1930s.
Okay, on that happy note, we'll move on. Yesterday, the head of Germany's domestic intelligence agency, Hans-Georg Maaßen, warned Europe about the threat of far-right militants willing to commit violent attacks across the continent. His comments come after Germany saw a jump in violent crime from far-right groups of 42% in 2015. And Danielle, this obviously links to some of what we've been talking about already. But there does seem to, you know, there is a link between the political rhetoric and hate crimes, isn't there?
I think so. We've seen that already in the last week in America. I mean, it's purely anecdotal, but it makes perfect logical sense. If your feelings of hate and anger seem to be legitimised by political leadership, well, hey, you know, why not go for it? I think what's frightening, though, is if a culture of impunity develops. I mean, countries deal well with hate crime when you build relationships with communities at risk, when you have the rule of law. I mean, I can speak from personal experience here in the UK. The Jewish community have very good relations with the police and with law enforcement officials, which means that hate crimes against the community are logged and they're reported, more importantly, because Jewish people in the UK will not be worried about going to the police and reporting anti-Semitic attack. But I don't think that's the same with other religious or ethnic minorities. I think that's the biggest danger. When you have a breakdown of trust between communities, then these things don't get reported.
That's the big problem, isn't it, Isabel? The secondary problem is not just these hate crimes taking place, but whether the communities affected feel that they have anyone who's actually going to stand up for them if they report it.
Well, absolutely. And we saw a similar surge in this country of incidents in, you know, people pulling down veils of women on buses, people just turning on people and insulting them on public transport in particular. And the kind of political discourse that we've seen over the last year does seem to make these people feel that their point of view has a legitimacy that it did not have before. I think they feel empowered. I think they feel that they have support. They may even feel that they now are in a majority. And that is very worrying indeed. I mean, we've had far-right terrorism for a long time. You remember Oklahoma. You remember the Danish murders of the in the youth camp with Breivik.
Anders Breivik in Norway.
Thank you. In Norway.
And also David Copeland here in the UK in 2000 with the nail bombs in Soho.
And the murder of Joe Cox.
You know, it's not a new phenomenon, but I think it is a newly empowered phenomenon. And In fact, you know, Trump's encouragement of violence at his rallies was a classic case. So, you know, I think that there are questions whether this forms a kind of far-right internationale in the way that the German police report seems to envisage. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about ultra-nationalists becoming transnational or whether this is a realistic prospect. You know, I think that there are transnational terrorist networks. I'm not sure that this will be one, but I think that they can do a great deal of damage to a great many vulnerable communities.
Danielle, do you think it's, you know, as we're saying, people are doing this because they feel they have license to do it now, whether that is because, you know, Donald's Trump election shows that this sort of language is okay, or Nigel Farage standing in front of a poster where it says breaking point with a huge picture of refugees behind him, and somehow that makes it okay for there to be, you know, to say what you really feel about people who are a bit different
down
from
with
you.
Political correctness, that
indeed
kind of thing.
Indeed, you should just be able to say exactly what you think. What do mainstream politicians have to do to try to counter that? And are enough of them doing enough?
Well, obviously, they don't have to go for the populist anti-immigrant and anti-minority vote, but I think that's asking a little bit too much, perhaps. And what is dangerous as well is in the course of these political campaigns, you open Pandora's box and you allow the discourse to reach a certain level, and it's very difficult to get it back from there because it becomes normalised. In a way, Germany is the country I'm least worried about in Europe over the next year. I mean, we have, what, 5 or 6 elections and referenda, one after the other. And as far as I'm aware, Germany is the only place where there isn't a serious danger of a major right-wing success. But the other fear is that these things have a snowball effect. I mean, I'm sure that historians in the future will look back and draw quite a straight line from Brexit to Trump and perhaps onwards, and perhaps that's, you know, they will simplify a little bit. But I think in terms of European politics, this is what's going to happen, and the populists and far-right groups in each country are going to be emboldened by the success that comes ahead of them.
Okay, we'll take a quick break now. When we come back, a little bit more Trump, I'm sorry, but don't worry, it's about 2 very important issues around the world, climate change and also China and the South China Sea. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Tall Stories is a new 5-minute audio snack from the team who bring you The Urbanist each week. In just a few minutes, we talk about one building, one statue, one park bench that has an interesting backstory, something special to reveal to us about life in the city in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes we'll get all historical on you, other times we might be yearning for modernity, but it's 5 minutes of urban diversion, an unplanned journey down the secret side streets of metropolitan life that will, we hope, keep you intrigued. Available every Monday, you can get it by subscribing to The Urbanist via monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Be a part of the story.
You're listening to Midori House, and what I promise you is going to be another 11 minutes of optimism about the world around us. Still with me, Isabel Hilton and Daniela Peled. 200 nations are currently involved in meetings at the COP22 climate change conference, organised by the United Nations, it taking place right now in Marrakesh. They're there to work out how best to implement 2015's historic Paris Agreement, designed to avert a future global warming catastrophe, or at least to make it not quite as bad as it could have been. One figure, though, of course, looms large over the event. Someone who's not there, Donald Trump, the new US president-elect, is, of course, a climate change denier. Isabel Hilton, we have a climate change denier in the White House, but we have had that before. So how pessimistic are you about the issue of climate change over the next 4 years?
Well, I think it doesn't help. But on the other hand, he can't blow it up. You know, by one of those delicious ironies, the United States today presented its deep decarbonisation plan to 2050. And John Kerry made an hour-long speech. And this is clearly the kind of trailing tatters of a vanquished.
Do you think if he carries on speaking for as long as possible?
Maybe it's his version of the filibuster. Yeah. But look, it is no coincidence that the Paris Agreement was ratified in record time and came into force, you know, at warp speed, really, for a UN convention, no, UN treaty, because they knew that if the American election went wrong, it would be too complicated. And you have had a pretty solid showing from the major emitters and the big countries, the big emerging economies, including India, to say, well, the United States may go in a different direction, but the rest of us will not. So that's 189 countries versus one, which will pretty much carry on. Where the United States can do damage, it's mostly to the United States. You know, if you try and turn the United States back at this point in history to a big fossil fuel economy and try to revive the coal industry, you're just wasting time and losing any technological lead that you might have. You're not going to bring coal back as a no. major force. What is going to be tricky, I think, is that, you know, we, Paris, big success, but the pledges in Paris take us to around 3 degrees. And the understanding always was that you would have to ratchet up those promises, the promises that the countries bring to the table in order to stay below 2 degrees. And that is going to be, obviously, there is going to be a missing element in that, which is the second biggest emitter, the United States. But the others, I think, will carry on. And China is going to step in. China sees action on climate change is absolutely in its own national interest. It wants to dominate the market in low carbon technologies. It's the next phase of its economic development. And if the United States goes missing, China will step up.
Daniela, do you think this is a different environment from post Kyoto, when George W. Bush, after he came into office in early 2001? Very quickly said, we're not ratifying the Kyoto Treaty. And there are a number of other countries alongside him that said, yeah, we're not too happy about this as well. There are also lots of countries like China who weren't involved in the first place. It feels like it's a different playing field now.
I think it is, but I think it's also different because of Trump's approach to so all these major issues. Now, you could say that a lot of his promises and his threats have been mostly bluster. And perhaps I'm being uncharacteristically optimistic about this because I'm more worried about NATO and so on and so forth. But I think he wants to make an impact. And he wants to make some sort of dramatic gesture so he can play to his own constituency without actually having to make any considered move, because I don't think there is one. I think he just says, well, we're going to leave it. We're going to get out of it. We're just not going to have anything to do with it. But the Paris Agreement, as I understand it, give him some leeway, because really the commitments that that America have made are voluntary. He can say, right, we're just not going to do anything. We're not going to do anything. Right. We're making a big stand. We're making America great again. We're not going to participate. Actually leaving would take a few years. I'm counting on this being a four year experiment. I think he wants to make a big statement, but I don't think it's going to translate into any major change. I just don't think he has the policy to replace it.
Well, he might make a statement that pleases his particular heartland, but I think that he would do it at the cost of America's standing. And, you know, open up the possibility of all kinds of retaliation. You know, there have been suggestions that if the United States really does drop out, then people would look at carbon taxes and tariff barriers against American goods. You know, there are, if America is really going to sacrifice its leadership in the world, I think it's worrying for all of us, but it's mostly worrying for the United States, because this is not the way history is going, and you can stand there telling the waves to go back, but they're not going to.
I think that's a major danger, because most global leaders are slightly governed by the soft power of consensus. You don't want to be the first person to leave the agreement. Doesn't seem to bother Donald Trump at all.
It doesn't bother Donald Trump. It would take him 3 years to leave the Paris Agreement, but he could simply withdraw from the whole UN process, and that would be faster. He could also, you know, make sure that no US finance goes into supporting emerging economies or poor countries in mitigation and adaptation, and that would certainly weaken the process. But again, there are others who might be very happy to fill the leadership role if the US vacates it.
Okay, let's see if we can continue. It's not necessarily all that bad tone right to the very end. I want to talk briefly about China, Isabel, because there is an argument that China is the big geopolitical winner from Donald Trump's presidency, because China's big thing right now is more influence in its own neighbourhood. And here's Donald Trump, who throughout the campaign said, Japan and Korea, they're on their own. As we've seen with Putin, he doesn't seem to have a problem with, playing nice with autocrats. Xi Jinping, is he, would you imagine, a rather happy man right now?
Well, I think he's certainly looking forward to not having to take any lectures on human rights from a country now led or about to be led by a man who's advocated torture and mass deportation. I think he's also quite happy to be able to point out to his own democracy advocates that democracy doesn't always produce a good result. So those are two clear wins. And I do think that it's an opportunity for him to say to the neighbourhood, and Japan and Korea will have reached this conclusion on their own, but also Vietnam, Malaysia.
Philippines.
Philippines has gone a bit iffy anyway. That the United States is now an unreliable ally and best stick with the neighbour who's not going to go away. So, yes, it could have, I think this will play out over time, and the Chinese will certainly play a long game. It's very hard to know what they think about Trump, since Trump has contradicted himself about 123 times over 46 policy statements, according to calculations done on his campaign. So it's hard to be definitive, but they will certainly take it very calmly and seize what opportunities present.
And this, Daniela, in a sense, has always been a problem for a democratic nation that relies on American support in its own backyard, because one day that support might just disappear.
Well, it's very hard to get a grip on this, as Isabel said. I mean, the current leader for Secretary of State, Rudy Giuliani, is now vowing to send hundreds of warships to the South China Seas. I'm not quite sure where they're going to go for. So they're talking several different talks at the same time, saying we don't want to get involved and we're going to leave you alone, and then saying yes, we are going to get involved in a really unrealistic way. No, I think I'm pretty sure that Beijing is fairly relaxed about this, about the next steps.
The only thing that I think Beijing would be worried about is that if a Trump presidency does cause too much global chaos, it's really not good for China. China likes a reasonably calm international environment. It needs to trade. The economy's slowing. It likes a certain amount of stability. But for instance, if TTP doesn't happen, and remember TTP was this massive trade agreement which included everyone but China, This opens a huge opportunity for China to form its own massive trade agreement with its neighbours, perhaps not including the United States. It'll be the Asian infrastructure bank all over again. So by the time the Trump presidency comes to an end in 4 or 8 years, we might find, as we did with the Bush presidency, that whilst the United States had been preoccupied with perhaps unproductive aspects of its foreign policy, China had just quietly filled the gap.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Daniela Pellet and Isabel Hilton, thank you very much indeed. We managed to balance that with sort of a bit of pessimism in the first half and more sort of...
What's not to like?
I don't know whether I'd say optimism, but sort of realism perhaps in the second half. Thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jake Fitzsimons. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's a bit more music next. Then at 1900, it's The Entrepreneur. Affairs with Daniel Giacopelli. And we'll have more on the day's top stories on the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 London time, 1700 if you're on the East Coast. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.